There's a reason why a business is doing 4 million. If it were doing different things, it would be 20 million. Sometimes I have that conversation with individuals that are looking to buy businesses. That's a whole different market. It's a really interesting market and really great. I meet with a lot of former executives that are now looking for businesses. And sometimes they get introduced to me and they ask me what I think about what kind of business they should buy and aspects of businesses to look for. And, you know, I just remind them that you're not going to get everything on your wish list in a business that's under a $5 million price point. Why? Because if it had your whole wish list, it would be a $25 million business, you know? So you're going to have make some concessions.
Lindsay, I'm so excited that you are joining us today on Pressure Tested. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here with you.
I know you have a crazy schedule, so I also follow you on social. So you like travel the world, and I know you're always busy, so it really doesn't mean a lot to me that you're making time to be here.
Oh, no. I'm so happy to be here. I'm thrilled.
Awesome. So I just want to hear kind of your whole, so I've sat down with you one time and you told me a little bit about your background and I just want to hear the whole thing. So like you went to college to be what and what do you do now?
Yeah, that was, it was an unconventional path, I would say. So I actually grew up in mergers and acquisitions and business valuation. My father has a business valuation M&A firm.
Okay.
So grew up working for him, grew up around deals in the business. But as I was going through school, I ended up sort of going down the like medical road. And I have a biology degree. So I went to SMU. I have a biology degree. But like around my senior year of college, because I had been around so many entrepreneurs and I'd seen people grow businesses in kind of strange areas you would never think of, I decided I wanted to start my own business. And the one sort of connection I had was family in the jewelry business.
Okay.
So I kind of got in the jewelry business, very long story short. I did my master's in London, then I was doing some work in Geneva, Switzerland, and I ended up raising capital in Geneva for my business and growing it there. I was based there for a few years, and I ended up selling that business in 2014, and I spent a little bit of time around then consulting for startups that had gotten funding in Singapore, also a long story, but I lived in Singapore for a few years there. And then I decided, you know, I did some soul searching and was really trying to figure out, like, what did I really want to do? And, you know, I just kind of kept coming back to my roots and really wanting to work with entrepreneurs and wanting to do something really meaningful. And M&A really felt like that was the fit. So, you know, moved back to the U.S. a little over 10 years ago, did some extra education, did my licensing, and got into business with my dad, actually. And we built an M&A group, and we actually merged that group with another firm at the beginning of COVID. It was like June of 2020.
Oh, wow.
And that was an interesting exercise in culture clash. So it didn't, I mean, I'm sitting here and I work for a different firm now, so
yeah.
It didn't like work out super well. It was a really great learning experience. I ended up exiting that and working for another well-established investment bank for a couple years. And then I met the folks at 414 Capital, the team. And they're actually really big in Latin America. And I learned about them wanting to grow in the U.S. and them seeing that as a really big opportunity and needing someone to kind of lead the charge. And I thought that was really interesting. And they have amazing resources. But I could kind of do something entrepreneurial. And so I joined 414 a little over 2 years ago. And that brings us to now.
So you run the office here in Dallas. Are you kind of by yourself?
Well, so there are three other people in Dallas. There are two, and then one starts at the end of the month. And then we have another managing director in Houston. I really kind of was the first and kind of paved the way. And now we're filling in the team, and we're hoping to continue the growth. You know, we've been lucky, we've been successful, and really just hoping to see more of that over the coming years.
That's amazing. I think that, and you glazed over it so humbly, but so you're in a foreign country at like what, 21 years old, mm-hmm. raising capital for a business that you were going to start? Like, that's insane.
It was insane. You know, if I knew how hard it would be, just all the things you have to do, and you know this very well, being a business owner, all the things, I probably wouldn't have done it. But, you know, I'm really grateful that I was kind of that delusional, because I learned so much. I even learned French pretty well because,
Okay, so you speak French. Do you speak other languages too?
No. Actually, you know, growing up in Texas, you learn Spanish.
And, yeah.
But like when I learned French, like all the Spanish just left.
Really?
And now, I really can't say a word, really. But, you know, my French, I try to keep up. My son goes to the French school. So,
really?
Yeah, I try to keep it a little bit, but, you know, I'm conversational. And
so that's amazing. Yeah. Good for you. That's so cool. So, okay, so you're in Europe. You start this business. Tell me, how in the world, so your family's in the jewelry business and you're,
what exactly did
you guys do? Did you just, explain it to me?
A lot of, like, import and I guess and some exporting, but we would do designs and then have them made abroad, you know, everywhere from China, Thailand, India, a lot of different places, actually, mostly in Asia. And they would send us the finished products, or they would send us a variety of components that we would assemble. Mm-hmm. Some of those things we could say made in Switzerland because of that.
Right.
And then when I was based in Switzerland, we would sell to stores all over Europe, some in the US, some in Asia, but a lot in Europe.
And you were ready to do something else. So you sold the business.
Yeah.
You went through your own transaction.
Yeah. And I had a banker. And part of what I think about as a banker now is that experience and, you know, what they could have done maybe better.
Oh, yeah.
And having been through it on that side. So it's something, you know, being a really good sort of shepherd for my clients is something that's really important to me. And it's a big part of what I do now.
Yeah. So, I mean, it obviously helps that you've been through it on both sides.
For sure.
Okay. So I feel like the average person, especially like somebody in the trades, they really have, okay, let's say that you are in the trades and you start at, you know, 20 years old, you're installing air conditioning, and then one day you start your own company and then you scale that company and you want to exit. M&A, investment banking, nobody knows what any of this actually means. Yeah. So, like, what is it that you actually do? And, like, kind of describe the world of M&A to us as if, you know, we don't know anything about it.
Happy to. And it's definitely an area that I find people find a little mysterious for whatever reason. I'm not totally sure. So when I am talking to people about what I do, I usually liken it to real estate.
Okay.
It's not the same thing, but you know, so when you want to sell your house, you usually kind of hire a real estate agent. They'll come in, they'll make your house, like, tell you what you need to fix, make it look great. They'll bring in buyers. They'll walk the deal from you wanting to sell all the way to closing the deal. Okay. And in a lot of ways, we do that same thing for businesses. However, you know, selling real estate, I'm not to belittle it at all, but it's a sort of a fixed asset that doesn't change a lot.
Right.
When you're working with living, breathing businesses, there are so many things to consider. And it's, of course, a different buyer universe. And so it's similar, but different,
sure, for
sure. But, you know, we meet with I'm typically working with sellers. There are investment bankers that work with buyers. My firm does work with buyers. Okay. I just happen to do more with sellers. So I'm typically working with a family or founder-owned business that's maybe 20 to 200 million in revenue. And so I'm working with those owners and helping them, you know, assess the business, get the business ready for sale, bring in the right professionals if need be for whatever work, you know, might need to be done before going to market. We launch the marketing process. We bring in the buyers. We work with a lot of private equity firms, but we usually include strategic buyers. That's usually a business or corporation in the same field that you're in. And we bring all those to the table. We, you know, hopefully have them bid against each other, get our client best price and terms, and then walk the deal to close.
That's amazing. Yeah, I don't think that, I think when most people think about, I think so many people do this without an investment banker is the other thing, which is like a little scary, right? Like we've been through a couple of M&A transactions, or we've been through a couple of like ones that get really close to the finish line and then failed. And, you know, most of the people that we were dealing with, they were not being supported by anybody else.
No.
So they were just kind of out on this open market, just like looking for somebody to come and pick them up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the ones that I would look at, like the financials were a mess.
Oh.
And, you know, they would think that the business was worth 10x or 7x. And you're like, yeah, no.
No.
It's like, you know, they didn't believe in recurring revenue. They thought that was a scam. Like, there's just like all these like things that all these things that they go through. And it's like, it's just amazing that not enough people realize that you need a professional to help you with that.
Yeah. I mean, can you sell a business without an investment banker? Sure. Do you want to? Probably not. For a lot of people, most of their net worth is tied up in this one asset, and it's their business, and you have a one-time sale. And, you know, why would you not hire a professional? If you were going to hire a professional to do anything in your life, why would you not hire them to help you with this? You'll probably make back their fee in a multiple just by getting organized and, you know, having them help you bring in competition and stay organized and do the things you need to do to get across the finish line. As you know, the due diligence process is, it's pretty hard on sellers. It's a lot. It's a lot to go through. And having that extra support, even someone saying this is normal, that's not normal. You know, that kind of guidance is really helpful.
Yeah, because, you know, different people ask different things of you. And then, like, I remember going through a couple of these transactions and, you know, we would ask, you know, in some we would ask some pretty basic questions, and they, you know, they don't even have like an internal accounting group because we're targeting really smaller, like mom and pop businesses. And so it's like, you know, you ask them really basic balance sheet questions and they have no clue.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay. You know, I remember it was funny. So we were like working through like target working capital. And like they didn't understand how the balance sheet was going to impact that. And I was like, okay, here's what you're going to do. And it's like, I'm telling them what to do, trying to buy the business. So it's like, you definitely need somebody telling you what to do.
And it's funny you bring up working capital, because that is a complicated subject that takes a lot of business owners. It takes them a little while to get the concept right and down, and having professional guidance with that, and making sure that you're negotiating it properly and that it's really fair is hugely important, I think.
Well, it's kind of crazy, the market. So middle market, 2 to 200 million. The difference in a $2 million company and a $200 million company, that like the professionals that you have at the different levels, like I bet it's wild, some of the stuff that you've seen.
Oh, vast. You know, we usually start working with businesses that are around 20 million.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Because below that, there just tends to be a lack of system and processes.
Sure.
Even at 20 million, there's usually not, like, there's usually not a CFO. There's usually not tons of systems and processes.
So we just did 21 at Heating and Cooling. We don't have a CFO.
I believe that.
And I'm thinking through the processes that we don't have that like a company like Utilities does have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and because that's really like an inflection point for a business. So, you know, do you absolutely need someone full time to be that CFO? Maybe not quite yet. Maybe that's like a fractional position you have, but you're definitely like starting to think about it. And it is starting to become something that's really important to a business of that size.
Yeah, I agree. Like we're going through all of that right now, because really when you're, and so like we're 21 million shooting for 31 this year. And so the things that are going to have to change, we have this huge like backlog of new construction residential work. So we actually have the backlog to kind of support that growth. It's not kind of like we're just sticking a number out there, like our backlog and the way we burn backlog off. I think that we will hit.
That's incredible.
Million. Yeah, it's wild. But the things that we need to put in place between where we're at today and how we just like, I mean, we kind of just accidentally managed to get to 21 million. It's like, so what we have to do between now to get to the 30, to get to the 31 is just kind of insane. It's like, that's really, it's like you said, that's the business like inflection point. Like what happens next to get you to the next, the next level.
And probably for you, it is bringing in those, the right professionals. Yes. It's bringing in the CFO. It's bringing in a really great controller if you don't already have one. Yep. It's building your infrastructure, which is a lot like of people kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, it is for sure. Because you can kind of get by with people that are good enough.
Yeah.
Until you get to that scale. And then they don't really have the wherewithal to manage what's next.
Yeah.
So people are a big component of it. I agree.
Yeah. And you know, we see that at different sizes of businesses and the growth that they're experiencing. Some people are really good at certain stages of growth, mm-hmm. but then they, you know, as the business gets bigger, you kind of need to reassess what your role is and maybe bring in other support to take on new roles or to, you know, make a role more robust.
Yeah, we were just talking about that today. So we're, you know, our goal is always to grow through M&A as well. And so we've only done one M&A transaction so far. We've looked at three, got really close on three, but we've only successfully done one. And we've kind of had to think, you know, because I led those deals, but it's like I'm an operator now. You know, so it's like, I don't necessarily know that I can also be the operator and lead the M&A transaction. It's like,
no.
What are you going to do? You know what I mean? Like, I can't focus on
those. Are two full-time jobs.
Those are totally different things. we're kind of going through all of those growing pains right now.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I can understand. And I see it every day. A lot of businesses I work with are at some version of an inflection point. And sometimes that kind of prompts the transaction. They're, you know, maybe at a place where the business is about to go through some sort of growth, or it's going through some sort of growth, and that could be really attractive to an investor. Mm-hmm. And also maybe the seller is looking to start taking steps backwards. And so that's when a transaction might make sense for a seller, you know, for their personal timing.
Do you think you see, I feel like, you know, on social media and just like, everyone will say that we're kind of going through a time where a lot of people, like the baby boomers that have had these businesses, because it was just like more attractive than to own a business, and especially like a trades business. Like we're really seeing this situation where a lot of them are wanting to get out kind of at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, do you see that at all in what you do? Or is it kind of a myth?
So I hear about this silver tsunami all the time. And, you know, honestly, I don't experience it. I haven't experienced it yet. I work with, you know, I'm thinking about the owners I'm working with now, and they're kind of, they span, you know, around 50 years old to maybe 70 years old. Okay. And they want to transact for different reasons. Some are for growth reasons. And I just haven't seen that, like, you know, clamoring to sell you know, it could be out there.
Yeah, or it could be completely bullshit. Who knows?
It's like, and it could be really certain parts of the market. It might be like slightly below where we work. Maybe there's a little more. There are more businesses
that makes sense.
of that size. So, yeah, it could be that too.
Yeah, because I mean, because you're at 20 million. I mean, you're an established business at that point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because a lot of these guys, especially, I see this a lot with kind of the older, like the owner that's 55 to 70. Like there was only so much growth that they were comfortable with. And they didn't see how they could grow the business bigger than like the $3-4 million top line that they've gotten to.
Yeah.
And so there's a big difference between the $4 million company and the $20 million company.
For sure. I mean, there's a reason why a business is doing $4 million. If it were doing different things, it would be $20 million.
Right.
And sometimes I have that conversation with individuals that are looking to buy businesses. That's a whole different market. And it's a really interesting market and really great. I meet with a lot of, you know, former executives that are now looking for businesses. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they get introduced to me and they ask me what I think about what kind of business they should buy and aspects of businesses to look for. And, you know, I just remind them that you're not going to get everything on your wish list in a business that's under, you know, a $5 million price point. Why? Because if it if it had your whole wish list, it would be a $25 million business, you know? So you're going to have make some concessions.
That's really good. Okay. All right. Well, tell the people what they want to hear. What kind of business do you tell people to buy?
So I can tell you the types of businesses that sell really well.
Okay.
So you mentioned it earlier, but recurring revenue is like the absolute gold in mergers and acquisitions. Recurring revenue, low customer concentration, and strong margins, that combination is really powerful. There are other value drivers, but there is a whole buyer universe that doesn't really care about industry, but wants to see that, and they will consider an investment. I mean, a lot of them also want to see a strong management team, a strong second layer of management, you know, low reliance on a single person. Mm-hmm. There are other value drivers, but recurring revenue and strong margins and low customer concentration, like a highly differentiated customer base, really attractive, which is why HVAC companies, as you know, are in high demand. And and so that's an area that trades really, really well. I mean, you'll landscaping, stormwater management, roofing, also businesses where, well, first of all, businesses that have maybe long-term contracts billed monthly, kind of like some of these businesses we're talking about. Yeah. I mean, those are highly desirable. But also businesses that are sort of mission critical, like HVAC, like roofing. I mean, you can't have a hole in your roof.
How does roofing have recurring revenue?
It's not recurring. It's reoccurring, like where there's like maintenance needed. Mm-hmm. In certain areas of the country, like Texas, like roofs,
hailstorms
are going to need work. Yeah. You know, there's a certain amount of, I would say maybe a certain amount of reliability that there will be work for you as a roofing.
Yeah. There's
business.
A huge amount of demand. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's funny that roofing businesses are also like so sought after.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, 8 years ago or so they weren't. And then I don't know, it's been the last like 4 or 5 years, it started slowly and then it's really picked up. I'm working with a couple currently and very interesting space. They get great multiples and, you know, depending on the different aspects of the business. But yeah, it's an interesting space. But other businesses like in professional services, think like IT managed services where, you know, you probably pay.
Everybody's on a contract.
Yeah, everyone's on a contract. Mm. And it's billed monthly.
Yeah.
And it's sticky. Yeah. Also, maybe like a CPA firm where, you know, you're doing taxes every year. Like those trade really nicely as well. Mm. So those kinds of businesses. But there are buyers for kind of every kind of asset. So, of course, there are buyers that are specific to healthcare assets. Oh, and I don't do a lot in healthcare. That's not really my space. I do much more in blue collar and industrial services, also professional services, manufacturing distribution. That's kind of the area that I'm in. So I see more things and I know a little more about that space.
I feel like I don't know anything about manufacturing because it's like, because I'm a former CFO, I think of everything from an accounting standpoint.
Yeah.
And like, so then I start thinking about manufacturing, how complicated the accounting is for like, as things are work in progress. Like, I don't even know. I think it's a work in progress. It's like, it's so complicated. Like, it's even more complicated than construction is. So,
well,
it's, like,
it's different. I mean, different. They probably think what you do is really complicated. I mean, it's just different. And when we're working with a company in any sector, we usually rely on really great professionals in those sectors.
And that makes sense.
You know, something we really ask all of our clients to do is it's called a quality of earnings analysis, a Q of E. And it's sort of an audit of your EBITDA, which is your earnings, to, you know, like, long story short, and, a Q of E really dives into a company's EBITDA and assesses, you know, how strong it is, how stable it is, a lot of different aspects of EBITDA, and then that report buyers can look at, and it can give extra confidence to the buyer when they're buying. I mean, at the end of the day, a buyer is going to do that same report during due diligence. So if the seller does it in advance, they can kind of get ahead of anything that is ultimately going to come out in due diligence.
Because I guess you have so many people that kind of come to you and they have all of this like stuff that they're adjusting EBITDA with, you know, like their salaries, their truck that they're driving, kids' school tuition, like they have all this stuff that they're adding back. And how does that, so, you know, let's say that you're running a $20 million business and you think you have all of these like real things that adjust EBITDA. How much do you really see that play out when they go to market?
We usually do have to adjust some of their adjustments. You know, I've seen people want to add back like health insurance for the company. And it's like, no, post-transaction, we need to have health insurance. You know, we can only add back things that are like one time in nature or will not be expenses post-transaction. So any of the sellers like perks.
Yeah.
But if, for example, and a lot of sellers want to add back all of their salary or, you know, what they're taking home that comes off the P&L. And that is like true and false at the same time. So what we need to know is what is the market rate salary for that position? Mm-hmm. Because if they exit the business, we're going to have to hire someone right. to do that same job for a certain price. Now, the owner currently might be paying themselves, you know, much more than the market rate. So we can add back that delta.
That makes sense.
But we can't add back the essential salary part that would be needed for a replacement.
So what you're telling me is I need a raise.
Yeah, you definitely need a raise. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so we're going to ask one more loaded question because I'm just picking your knowledge about future M&A transactions. But what do you think of businesses that have a lot of so we'll just play out a scenario. Let's say that you have an HVAC business and this HVAC business has acquired other assets, but they haven't ever like rebranded to one asset. Mm-hmm. How does a buyer look at that? I mean, now you have the EBITDA, you have the recurring revenue, you have the low customer concentration, but everything's a different brand. How does that play out?
Are those different brands using the same systems and processes, or are they really operating individually?
They're operating off of the same proven process, if you will.
Yeah.
But they're all, you know, different marketing, different brands, maybe even different like geographic areas.
Yeah, you know, I think a buyer, I haven't really seen that specific scenario play out, I take that back. I did work on a transaction last year where there were a few different brands that even did slightly different things, but they all rolled up into kind of one P&L.
Okay.
And, you know, it was an attractive industry to be in. It was a services kind of business, industrial services. And the buyers were, you know, completely fine with it. Mm. We didn't really have too much conversation either way about them having different branding. And I don't think the buyers necessarily wanted to change the branding post-transaction. Mm. You know, I think they saw that the business worked well. It had been operating like this for 20 plus years. And I think they wanted to build off of it, not necessarily come in and rebrand it.
Okay, you've worked on hundreds of deals, thousands of deals probably. Can you look back at one and say, wow, that was such a cool experience, or you just love that deal, you love the deal that you got for the seller, I mean, any of it. Like, what can you think of one transaction?
Honestly, every transaction is so unique and has its own, you know, its own journey and story. I will say last year I worked on a deal in the lake and pond management space and really enjoyed working with this client and really enjoyed learning about the business. And we had an exceptionally competitive process. There were a lot of people interested in the business. And it was just such a fun transaction to work on and to see that level of response from buyers and to see such a great outcome for the seller.
Wow,
was awesome. Really, really cool. It was a great transaction and definitely sticks out.
like, there's got to be some emotion to it. Like, these people build these businesses, and, like, on the other side of these businesses, they become rich. Like, 100%. They have all the money that they need for their family. I mean, there might even be, like, generational wealth involved 100%. In this. Like, what is that like to get to see somebody kind of get to the finish line on something like this?
I mean, it's incredible. It's what's really cool about my job. You know, again, a lot of these people's net worth is tied up in this one asset, and it's their business. And we help them really monetize it and create that liquidity event for them that often does create generational wealth. And it's a really exciting process, but to your point, it's a highly, highly emotional process. You know, there's a lot of the net worth tied up. There's a lot of the personal self-worth that's tied up also in that business. So, you know, when we start going to market and we're, you know, kind of telling these buyers all about the business, and they get to judge it and ask questions about it and probe. And, you know, there are things that come up for sellers with that. And then, you know, someone throws you a lowball offer and it's highly offensive to this thing you built, you know, and
I see that.
Or, you know, you get into due diligence and they want to try to retrade you on something that, you know, you think is silly or whatever. Like, there are just a lot of emotions that can come up, or you end up in a fight about working capital at the very, very end of the deal. And, you know, your seller is like so stressed from the, you know, the pending transaction that, you know, they might just be at their wits end. You know, on this same subject, whenever I meet with a prospect before they're even a client, I always tell them, I want you to remember this. At some point in the process, you will have at least one nervous breakdown. And, you know, they usually laugh. And then I say, I want you to remember I'm saying this because when it's happening, I'm going to flag it. You're not going to like it. But what I suggest is you take a day, you know, spend some time with your family, don't make any decisions. And then, you know, let's get back together after a couple of days and refocus on the goal. We'll get creative. We'll figure it out, you know, and kind of eye on the prize. And it happens, like, in every single transaction. And I'm so relieved that I tell people that up front, because then I can say, like, it's happening, because it does happen.
Wow, I bet. And you, like, have to champion the whole thing. You have to stay cool, calm, and collected through the whole thing.
Yeah, you know, I've seen enough. You know, I've seen deals that just really should have died. That, like, you know, I had this one deal in, it was in chemical coatings, anything that could have gone wrong throughout the transaction, like the financials being wrong, and the CPA went into retirement because he didn't want to answer questions anymore.
What?
And there were, like, all these violations that were coming up, like environmental violations, and I mean, so many things. And our original buyer backed out, and then we had another buyer, you know, when we were in market, so we went back to them. And they ended up doing the deal after some time. And, like, that deal really made me feel like if that deal can close, any deal can close.
That's funny. That's good to hear. That's great to hear. Yeah, I bet. I bet that's a lot to manage and a lot to deal with. And so many different – one of the things that it's funny that we went through just looking at this. So we worked on a deal all summer. We thought it was going to go through. But – you know, like, outside of the time we spent on due diligence, outside of the time we spent kind of figuring out if this business was right for us, I was, like, playing therapist with this guy. Like, we were – he doesn't listen to my podcast, I'm sure, so I'm comfortable saying this. But, I mean, we would be on the phone, like, for 2 hours, and I would be, like, talking him off the ledge that this was a good idea. Like, it was insane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
100%. There's so much babysitting.
He needed a banker. Like, because, you know, I have clients, I've had multiple clients, many clients that will call me, like, every day at 7:30, and they just want to hear everything's going to be okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that would be me. I would be calling every day. I'd be like, okay,
yeah,
what'd you find out today?
Yeah.
Like, I would be that annoying client because I would just want to know.
You know, but I don't mind it at all. Like, it's just part of the territory.
Yeah.
And, and I get it. Like, I get the nerves, and especially in certain parts of the process.
Sure.
You know, not the whole process, but there are moments where, like, for a few weeks, you just want to hear, like, you still think it's okay. You still think this is going to happen, you know, like this is going to happen, right? And it sounds like that person really needed kind of a sounding board.
Yeah, well, and it's sad because it didn't happen. And okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how many times you've had to kind of champion that something was going to happen and a deal was going to get done and then it just doesn't. Like, what's that
happen.
Like?
It does happen.
That's got to be tough.
Yeah, it's really tough. And, you know, sometimes it's just really unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had deals fall apart for a number of reasons. You know, it could be that we go under LOI, we're in the due diligence phase, and the company kind of starts underperforming.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the buyer wants to renegotiate the price and the seller doesn't want to renegotiate the price, and then it ends up falling apart.
Yep.
That can happen. It could be kind of in a similar vein, like they lose a customer in the middle of the transaction and buyer wants to renegotiate price. There's more risk involved now. Mm-hmm. So they want to account for that and seller doesn't want to do that. That can happen. Or, you know, it could just spook a buyer and the buyer could go away. I had a deal really close to closing once and a background check came back not great. And the buyer walked. You know, they're an institutional investor. They're investing on, you know, a lot of these private equity firms, they're investing on behalf of like endowment funds.
Sure.
They can't be investing with certain types of people with certain backgrounds.
Yeah.
And it kind of didn't matter whether something happened 20 years ago or how minor it was. Like, it was mostly because it wasn't disclosed up front.
Sure.
They couldn't like get ahead of it.
Yeah.
And
no, it would spook an entire investment group. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that has happened. I'd say the most common thing I see is a business underperforming, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had a few great years. They want to go to market. Then it starts like they start having a few bad months and then we're in the process. Mm-hmm. And then we get to LOIs and then we're being asked, how's the business trending? And we have to say, well, it's not quite on projections. And, you know, and then, you know, some sellers are totally get it. And they're like, okay, we missed the mark here. We still want to transact. We want an investment partner who can like take us to the next level. Like there are many reasons to do this deal. And there are others that, you know, it's hard stop. Like we're not going to do this.
Yeah, it's a tough world out there for sure. Have you ever had somebody come to you and you look at the business and you just have to be like, hey, sorry, you're not ready for this?
Yeah, I mean, I get introduced to a lot of businesses. And so I don't know what the percentage is, but I work with very few compared to how many I'm introduced to.
Interesting.
But I always try to help the businesses that come to me. So if they aren't ready yet, I will suggest they meet with whatever professional I think is going to take them to the next level.
That's
and
great.
I will put them in touch with those people. I have a really wide network with amazing professionals that I rely on for all kinds of things. And so I'm very happy to help those people like kind of get to the next phase. And hopefully they will be at a place where I can then really be of service to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. You can't take every deal that comes in front of you and nor would you want to, I'm sure.
No. And it can be for a lot of reasons. It could be, I saw a company recently that was doing great, but it had only been established for, I think it was like just around the 2-year mark.
Wow.
And, you know, there's just not a lot
that's
of
a really
track
young business.
Record. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like straight up. And, you know, I that's just really tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, also,
you need to know how it's going to do over
time. Buyers want to see a little bit more of a track record. Most buyers.
That makes sense.
There might be a buyer out there that's fine with it, but not a lot of the buyers I see.
Yeah.
It could be that a business has had really like wild swings in their financials.
Oh, yeah.
That can be really difficult to explain. It's not impossible to overcome that. There are a lot of groups that really pride themselves on being operational and, I mean, investment groups that pride themselves on being operational and really being able to boost performance.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So sometimes they look for assets like that. But in general, that makes a process hard to run. There are those kind of reasons, or financials have kind of like been trending lower and lower.
Mm.
You know, that's another reason.
So it's better to if you're looking at a deal, it's better to, I mean, because I think it takes a business about 5 years to really make money. That's just what I think.
For sure.
That's been my experience with the different companies that I've worked for. And so, you know, you have those really like shaky first years where it does not look good and no one's interested. But then if you can prove kind of, or you can show a trajectory of slowly climbing out of that, you're saying that would be a lot better than having a good year and a bad year. And a good year. So you want to see the trend that things are continually improving.
Yes. I mean, really, in my opinion, the ideal, you know, graph looks like slowly up and to the right, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
We can tell like a really great story. Yes. There's a strong narrative there. We don't have to be like, oh yeah, this happened that year and then that happened this year. And, but don't worry, it's all good. You know, like that's hard. But up and to the right, yeah. Even if it's
that's
slow,
the way it needs to look.
We love that.
I love that too. That's funny. Yeah. I do feel like there are a lot of people out there that I was just sitting with somebody the other day and they were talking about what they do. I think that they worked at a family office and they said that they really like to invest in companies that they feel like they can put the people in, the operational people in,
yes.
to really take it from being like mid-level performance to like that next level.
Yes.
And that makes sense. I mean, because I guess investors like that are going to be able to see that better than the average operator.
Absolutely. And there are some groups where they really look for those specific kinds of opportunities where a business might be like just kind of underperforming. Maybe it has a foothold in a market, but just kind of bumping along.
Yeah.
And then there are many, many investors that don't want to be operational at all. Mm. You know, they want to know that there's a strong second layer of management if the owners are looking to exit, and they want to know that the business is in safe hands and can continue to operate and grow.
How many of your deals do you think go to some sort of investment group that's actually going to hold the asset long term? And how many of them do you think go to like a private equity play where they're just going to roll it up and try to sell it for profit in however many years?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably about 50-50, and I'll tell you why. Okay. I'd say about half the time our businesses are being sold to strategic buyers. Mm. So it might be a publicly traded company that is, you know, adding on, and they're going to integrate, and that business is never going to be, you know, anything else ever again. It's going to be part of this larger entity.
Right.
If you're talking about like financial sponsors that are going to hold it for long term, very rare. You know, there are family offices. There are a few funds out there that are kind of for long-term holds. But, you know, a lot of investors, a 10-year lockup is a long time. They want to see their money back in, you know, in about 10 years.
Makes sense.
So, so a lot of those funds are sort of in a place where they really need to transact in that 5-year mark. Once they acquire an asset, they're kind of on a timeline.
Yeah, you know, we see that a lot in the HVAC space because private equity seems to be very hot and heavy in HVAC. And so,
yes.
You know, the first company I ever worked for, great company, they sold to private equity a few years ago. And within, I think, 3 years, that private equity group sold, and then they sold again to Service Experts.
Mm-hmm.
And just the company itself really kind of suffered. The people, you know, there was always somebody to replace the next person because they were getting bought out, and company culture kind of died. And that's not to say that all those situations happen like that. I think in HVAC, people are almost scared of that now. They have this like idea that if PE comes in, it's just going to kind of gobble it up and you know, blow it up a little bit.
Yeah, I will say HVAC has been inundated by private equity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of joke with my M&A friends, like, are you even a private equity firm if you don't own an HVAC company? I mean, that's the real question. I mean, I do all these deal source events all over the country. So it's almost like speed dating where all the investment bankers have a table and every 20 minutes a new private equity firm comes by. Yeah, they give us their one pager. We talk about what's in my pipeline. They talk about what they're looking at.
Interesting.
And so we are able to connect on deals.
Hmm.
So I do those all year. And it's funny, on their one pagers, almost all of them have an HVAC company.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. I bet you get solicited like all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I tell them all the same thing.
No. Yeah.
We're not ready.
Yeah.
You saw the financials, you'd understand. Okay, let me ask you this. Why do you think that you're the only female investment banker I know? maybe there are more. I feel like I'm pretty well connected in the financial world in DFW, and you were the only female investment banker I know. So
I am also one of very few. I'm trying to even think of like one other female investment banker in Dallas that I, you know, is in the middle market, and I'm not coming up with anyone. I think it's a few things. I think the career path in investment banking is kind of intense and might not appeal to some women. I don't know. There are plenty of careers that are super intense that women are in. I think it's not marketed to women.
There we go.
So I think it's a profession that's not really marketed to women. I'm not quite sure why. And then, you know, the first few years are brutal, the analyst level.
I bet.
But, you know, that's like being an attorney or med student or, you know.
Or even like a CPA that's just entering a tax book. I mean, you're getting the grunt work.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I'm just thinking out loud. So it's probably a marketing problem. But I love working with younger women that are coming up in investment banking or in finance and really encourage them to think about investment banking. My firm actually has quite a few women, which is really cool.
That's amazing.
I've never worked at a firm that's had more than like one other female.
That's cool.
So yeah, it's very cool.
Well, I think that like when I really think about what you do, I just think that there's a lot of female bankers that I know that would be really great at what you do, you know? So it's just like, it's interesting to me, but I also think that there's a lot of work to get to where you are, and, you know, family situations don't always line up to that. There's a lot of reasons.
Absolutely. There are a lot of reasons, and it's, you know, it's kind of a weird niche of a profession to get into as well. Like whether you're female or male, it is kind of a funny place to end up, especially, you know, it's one thing to go kind of into the bulge bracket banks and get recruited out of college, but to be a middle market banker, it's kind of niche-y.
Agree with that. We have a lot of like mutual friends in the banking world around DFW. Something that I always just think is so tough on bankers, because I've seen it so many times, and I'm sure you deal with this too, but sometimes owners are ruthless. Like, they can be downright, not going to drop an F-bomb, but mean.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they will let some stuff fly. And you're like, oh my gosh, is this person like shrinking at their desk wherever they're receiving this email? Like,
yes.
It can be, it's not for the faint of heart.
No. And, you know, I would say earlier in my career, I had a lot more of those types of clients. I'm a little more picky now that I can be a little
picky.
You can't always tell how someone's going to be under stress, but you can kind of tell just generally, you can get a sense for a person. And at the end of the day, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, when they're freaking out, it's usually something that I know is going to be totally fine.
That's good.
Everything is figure outable. So we just have to figure it out. And you know, luckily I don't deal with that too much. I mean, I've seen some things, but no, I mean, I'm really lucky. I work with some amazing owners, and in the last few years, it's just been like such a pleasure, really.
That's amazing. So where do you go from here? What do you want to achieve?
That's a really good question. Honestly, I love what I do. What I really want to see happen is for 414 Capital's U.S. presence to grow.
Okay.
So, you know, we've added in the last year to Dallas, and, you know, we're looking for office space now. A lot of the team is based in Mexico City, actually. So all of my deal teams get staffed out of Mexico City. So all of my deals have like 3 or 4 bankers on them, and they're amazing. Down there, they're working on, you know, oftentimes much bigger deals, public company deals, and I get those same resources for my middle market deals.
That's amazing.
Which is really
cool.
Great. Yeah. And, you know, I would just like to see our office and our presence grow in the U.S. And we're kind of doing it, but, you know, I'd like to continue to see that. So that's kind of what's on my radar.
That's amazing. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today. This was so great.
Thank you for having me.